Call the meeting to order for the August 26th, 2014 meeting of Stansera. Can we have the roll call, please?
Donna Riley?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Gordon Ford?
Here.
Maria DeAnda?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Jason Gordo?
Here.
Mike Lynch? Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Joan Clendenin?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Do we have any announcements? No public, so we don't have to worry about that. Does, on the consent item 5, does anybody wish to pull any item?
I move to approve consent items.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Passed unanimously. So we move on to item 6, update from PIMCO.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to see all of you again. By way of reintroducing myself, my name is Matt Clark. I've had the pleasure of visiting with you for the last several years, and so it's great to be back before you today. I'm joined by my colleague, Sasha Talcott. Sasha joined us in 2012 and has been a key member of our public channel team, the team that only works with public pension plans. Both Sasha and I have had the pleasure of working with many of the California county systems, and obviously including Stansera. So we're looking forward to a good discussion with you all today. Now, Paul asked us to try and wrap up by 5 p.m., so we'll be completely contingent on your time needs. But we had planned to share with you an update on the performance of your portfolio. We also talked a little bit about what's going on in the marketplace. We wanted to share with you our outlook. And, of course, PIMCO's been in the news. We've had some significant evolution to our leadership structure. So we plan to spend a few minutes discussing that with the board. That was the order that we were thinking of, but we're happy to go in any order that you would like us to go. If you'd like us to start with an organization update, we can begin there. We can start with the performance. Does the
take order. It away.
Okay, great. So, and we were thinking that usually 30 minutes is more aligned to what the board actually needs in terms of the time that you'd like to invest.
Beautiful.
Sasha and I aren't going anywhere, though, but if you want us to stay longer, please let us know. One, if you'll turn with me to page 4, start with the performance review. And I guess the first thing I would draw your attention to is that we are responsible for just over $100 million on behalf of Stansera and Stansera's participants. We very much trust, we very much appreciate the trust and confidence that you place in us. We've had the good fortune to work with you since 2010, so we're pretty far advanced in terms of our relationship in that regard. If you drop down to the bar charts in the middle of the page, in the blue we're showing you the portfolio's performance, and the gold we're showing the benchmark performance. And what you'll notice is that the account outperformed in 2011, 2012, and then modestly underperformed in 2013, and we're a little bit behind the benchmark this year, and we'll talk about some of the drivers for that. If you go down to the bottom, we have the table that provides the period returns. Now, everything to the left of that one small column is through June 30th, so what you'll notice is that for the quarter ending June 30th, the portfolio returned 1.9% and the benchmark returned 2%. If we go further back in time on a calendar year-to-date basis, the portfolio returned 3.5% and the benchmark returned 3.9%. And then as you go further back in time for the 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, the longer term performance is slightly ahead of the benchmark. The 3 year mark is 3.8% versus 3.7%, and then for the since inception returns, we're outperforming the benchmark by about 0.5% or 40 basis points. Just before I comment on the overall performance summary, one thing to keep in mind is that this is intended to be a core portfolio, so it's really designed to be focused on a diverse set of strategies across the three major segments of the broad bond market, treasuries, mortgages, and credit securities. What's a little bit different about PIMCO relative to your other manager is that we tend to rely less on credit securities and corporate exposure, and we intend to rely a little bit more on things like interest rate strategies or exposure to mortgage-backed securities as a way of generating returns. And the reason I bring that out is that the two portfolios together, I think, serve as a really nice complement to one another. We've been in here in years past where Dodge & Cox has had a little bit of a challenging environment to get through. while we've been performing better. And then this is a type of environment right now where we've had a little bit more performance challenges. And I think you're probably finding a more credit-oriented approach delivering some additional value. So we think the two allocations complement each other very nicely. Let me talk about the what's happened year-to-date in that column, because I think that really sums up the performance environment that we've been in. As you can see, the bond market's done very well on a year-to-date basis. Again, this is that far-right column, 4.7% for the broad bond market. Your portfolio has returned 4.1%. Again, this is through the middle of August. Actually, if we were to sort of roll the tape forward to yesterday's close, the bond market's returned 4.5%, and your portfolio's returned 3.93%. So strong absolute returns, but why the underperformance in the portfolio? Well, to be very direct, we simply got the interest rate call wrong at the beginning of the year. We came into the beginning of the year expecting interest rates to move higher, and we were particularly worried about longer maturity interest rates, 10-year Treasury rates and 30-year Treasury rates. And if you kind of cast your mind back, the 10-year Treasury was in the neighborhood of 3%, the 30-year Treasury was in the neighborhood of 4%. And we thought the risks were very much balanced towards those rates moving higher as the Federal Reserve looked to normalize policy and we expected inflation to pick up a little bit. And we all expected that to be reflected in higher, longer-dated Treasury rates. So when designing the portfolio's exposures, we put exposures into the portfolio to protect from that dynamic. But we also emphasized short to intermediate securities because they offered a good amount of yield per unit of interest rate exposure. And we expected that, all things being equal, that area of the maturity spectrum would be more stable than 10 and 30-year securities. Now, as it's played out, the exact opposite has happened. 30-year securities have rallied roughly, call it 60, 70 basis points, or 0.6 to 0.7%. I think it's fair to say it's a surprise to many people in the market, and certainly not what we were expecting. And essentially what's happened is that the broad bond market, because of the performance of longer maturity securities, has gone up quite a bit. Your portfolio, while it's generated good positive returns, hasn't been able to keep up with that dynamic because we were more defensively positioned in regards to longer rates at the beginning of the year. Now, we're still somewhat cautious on longer rates. We've moderated that a little bit. But if you were to look through the portfolio right now in terms of interest rate exposure, you'll see that we have our biggest overweight to sort of that, call it 10-year part of the maturity spectrum. And the reason for that is because we feel still that that portion of the maturity spectrum offers the best yield characteristics per unit of risk that we're taking. So what you have is a high-quality, very diverse portfolio. The average credit quality is AA-. It's performed well on an absolute basis, but again, because we misassessed the interest rate dynamics for the first half of this year, it has underperformed on a year-to-date basis. And let me just pause before I go into a little bit more market review, but that's the key point that I'd have you take away from the performance.
So you still anticipate a rise in interest rates. Do you also anticipate that other countries will rise interest rates, or yeah. Do you think they'll be lowering, or what will happen?
I think one of the most interesting dynamics, and we think one of the most interesting dynamics that's going on right now, is the way the world has sort of broken apart from each other. So we think that in places like the Eurozone, Europe, and Japan, they will struggle to see interest rates go higher from here. And while the bias in the United States is for interest rates to move higher, particularly with the Fed normalizing rates, we think in the middle of next year, that broader global environment of economic weakness will act as a little bit of a bit of gravity to U.S. Treasury rates. Think if you're a world investor and you're looking around and say, well, where do I want to put my money in a lending to a government? You can go to Germany and you can lend to them for 10 years and earn 1%. You can go to Japan and lend to them for 10 years and earn substantially less than that. In that sort of context, lending to the U.S. government at 2.5%, even though it strikes us here as very low, isn't that unappealing to sort of global capital as it moves around. And so that fear that interest rates are going to violently reset to higher rates, particularly for 10 and 30-year maturities, we think that that's less of a risk now in the environment we're in, largely because of the weakness outside the United States. The U.S. is actually really doing pretty well by a lot of different metrics. And Sasha will talk a little bit more about why we think that will continue.
We saw plenty of other active managers at the beginning of the year have a lower duration.
Yeah.
Some of them offset that and even added value versus the benchmark versus with other deviations on their risk budget, what prevented you from offsetting that?
Paul, that's a great question. I think the thing that prevented us from offsetting that was that we were more conservatively positioned in regards to riskier segments of the market. And a really good example, which we still continue to expect to pay off, is in the area of agency-guaranteed mortgage-backed securities. Now, this is a very safe area of the broad bond market. It typically offers incremental yield relative to the Treasury market. So by investing in those, you generate a little bit better performance. But we looked at that sector of the market at the beginning of the year, and because the Federal Reserve has been buying a lot of these mortgages to keep mortgage rates low and spur economic development, we thought they were very, very expensive. And they've actually performed reasonably well this year, despite the fact they were very, very expensive at the beginning of the year. In the same vein, at the beginning of the year, corporate securities offered very low incremental yield for lending to corporations. On the whole, I think it's fair to say that we've been a bit surprised by the strength that we've seen in the U.S. economy over the last 6 months. So those securities which we looked at and said, gosh, those are awful expensive, their fundamentals have actually improved because of the economic environment. And so by not having more of that, we weren't able to offset the effect of the interest rate positioning. Now, there were other things in the portfolio that did well. I mean, we do have corporate exposure. We do have select non-agency mortgage-backed security exposure. We do have select agency-guaranteed mortgage-backed securities exposure. All those things helped, but they weren't there in presence to a significant enough degree to offset the interest rate positioning. And I think, to sum it all up, if anything, we kind of came into this year more cautious in regards to the Treasury market, more cautious in regards to the corporate market, more cautious in regards to the mortgage-backed security market, and that's why the portfolio is underperformed in a year when the bond market has done very, very well.
Yes, sir. If we look at the performance chart at the bottom, it looks like this is a question of timing of returns. Are your returns lumped, or are they smoother? And the reason I ask is the two-year number, you've underperformed for the last 24 months, but outperformed since inception and basically on par with the benchmark on the three-year number. So did you get really lucky early in the relationship?
Right.
And you've not had as good of luck today?
Right.
And that's why the performance is bad looking backwards?
You know, very fair question. We performed well in the first 2 years of the relationship, and a variety of different strategies have worked throughout. Over the last 2 years in particular, the interest rate positioning has hurt us. And so on the whole, it hasn't been as lumpy as you describe it. You can see that, you know, 2011, 2012 outperformed, and then modest underperformance in 2013 and 2014. So it hasn't been quite as lumpy as maybe it appears from the table below. But in a nutshell, we had a very good 2012, which helped that 3 year number sort of get above the 2 year dynamic, as you pointed out. And part of that was very much reflective of, in 2012, we identified the agency guaranteed mortgage backed security market as being very, very underpriced. We were willing to take a significant overweight in that area and were rewarded for that. That's one of the strategies that's worked well. The duration positioning, the interest rate sensitivity positioning has not worked well over the last 2 years.
So I look at Paul's later attachment in the fee schedule. It looks like we pay about $92,000 a year. What, going forward, do you believe, how will you add value going forward to earn the $91,000?
Yeah,
because we're basically on par with the benchmark.
Right.
A costless benchmark.
Right, right. Well, and I would say that since inception, I mean, again, we acknowledge that the short-term performance has been disappointing. We're not happy with it. From a longer-term perspective, we fully expect to deliver value because that's why you've hired us as an active manager. If you flip with me to page 7, what you'll see on page 7 is a snapshot of how your portfolio is positioned. And the first thing that I bring to your attention is that this portfolio does look very different than what you're going to get in the benchmark. So you're not just sort of being delivered benchmark strategies. You're delivered a very set of diverse strategies, which we expect to achieve your performance objectives over time. you know, one area that I would point to in terms of helping get that relative return back above the benchmark on the more shorter-term basis is that underweight to mortgage-backed securities. We talked about how the mortgage-backed security market is very, very expensive right now. It's expensive because the Fed has been buying many of these securities. As the Fed stops that program, which should happen in October, we expect the prices of those securities to fall as that buyer steps away from them. And as those prices fall, we'll be able to buy them at much more attractive levels. That will be a source of outperformance for the portfolio. If you look at the credit exposure, even though it's underweight to the overall benchmark, we're working very, very hard to identify the absolute most attractive credit opportunities. And when you sort of add the credit exposure that we have in addition to some of the other exposures in the portfolio, on a risk basis, we feel that we have the right amount of corporate securities, the right type of corporate securities in to outperform the type of corporate securities that you'll get in the benchmark. And so I would say that our corporate security selection will be an area where we will continue to deliver value, and I look to have value from that going forward. And then finally, on the far right, as you look to other strategies, these are all things that are sort of outside the benchmark that we think will deliver incremental value. So as an example, in the benchmark, it's not exposed to inflation-linked securities. We have roughly a 4.5% market value weighting to inflation-linked securities. We think those will outperform nominal securities, particularly longer-dated ones. We have select municipal exposure in the portfolio. All of these sort of security selection techniques we think over time will be rewarded as credit fundamentals continue to improve. That will generate additional performance. And the way it's all reflected in sort of a summary statistic is that if you look at the yield to maturity, you'll see that at the very top left-hand corner, the yield to the maturity of the portfolio is roughly 2.3%. You're getting that with a AA minus average credit quality. The benchmark's yield is closer to 2.1%. We've structured a very high-quality portfolio that out-yields the benchmark, that has a set of diverse strategies that we fully expect to outperform as we go forward in time, even if the more recent environment has been difficult for us and for others as well.
Forgive me, is there a maturity chart in here?
No, we don't have it broken down by maturity. We just have the summary duration statistics for you at the very top.
So is it more of a laddered portfolio or a barbell?
It's primarily actually a bullet where the largest overweight is at the 10-year portion of the maturity spectrum. To give you a sense of that, if you were to say, well, put the 5 to 8 year spectrum of the maturity universe, that's where we're getting the bulk of our interest rate exposure. And the reason for that is that that area of the yield curve offers the most yield per unit of interest rate sensitivity. And that's why we continue to like that segment of the maturity spectrum.
And that segment as well, when you hold those securities, it appreciates in price over the year at more than other sections of the yield curve. So you actually earn an extra return through that price appreciation by being on that section of the yield curve as well.
So to sum up, again, there is a range of very diverse strategies, not relying on any one particular sector or segment of the bond market, that we fully expect to deliver value to you as we go forward in time. But you know, no one at PIMCO is particularly pleased with coming to any of our clients, and I'm certainly not pleased coming to you and explaining why we're roughly 0.5% behind the bond market in a year when the bond market has had very good returns. We've talked a lot about performance and also the way the portfolio is structured. Maybe, Sasha, unless you'd like some final thoughts on the structuring, but then we could turn to the outlook, and then I'll turn to the organization update.
Yeah, maybe outlook might make sense. All right. This is on page 9. And I'll just step back and give a brief reminder of our economic forum process and how we get to the outlook. And the outlook, of course, will have a large impact on how we positioned your portfolio going forward. So every May, we have what we call our secular forum, where we look out over the next 3 to 5 years and identify the key trends that we see going on in the global economy. And also, during the year, we have a cyclical forum, which looks out over the shorter period. In the last May, we saw really a couple of key things going on in the global economy. The first is that the global levels of debt in the economy have not diminished since the financial crisis. Of course, we see in the United States debt has come down a little bit. But that has been offset by an increase of debt in other places. And so the net result being no decrease in debt since coming out of the crisis. The other thing we've seen is in developed countries, a whole host of structural issues. First of all, of course, the retirement of the baby boom generation, but also the long-term unemployed workers increasingly then dropping out of the labor force rather than deciding to come back in at some particular point in time. What that leads us to is the conclusion that the potential of the economy, the ability of the economy to grow over time, is likely to be lower than it was in the decade before the financial crisis. You think about the economic growth being more like 2-2.5% at its potential, rather than the 3% growth that we're used to. What that means from an investment perspective is that the level of interest rates needed to sustain that 2.5% growth is also then going to be lower than it was historically. So what we've shown on this very complicated looking slide on page 9, the left hand side, where you see the zero highlighted, is the real policy interest rate in the United States, in our view. And of course that is being could be brought up by things like labor force participation would increase the interest rate. If corporations came back into the mix, that would increase the interest rates. But the three factors that I mentioned, particularly the structural overhangs from the crisis and the high levels of debt, we believe are pulling that interest rate much lower than it's been historically. The Fed, if you looked at their notes for the longest time, they've thought that real interest rate's around 2%, the equilibrium interest rate. We think it's probably now closer to zero given these structural dynamics. What you see on the right-hand chart is actually what you see is the same thing as on the left-hand chart. It's just that it's adjusted for inflation. So that a 0% real rate would just be adjusting by the Fed's target of 2% inflation, meaning 2% nominal. Given that we believe that overall interest rates in the economy on a go-forward basis are likely to be lower, there's a couple of different ways to get there. The first is, of course, the Fed takes longer to raise interest rates than the market expects and ultimately ends at a lower plateau. But the second is that the Fed actually raises a little bit too much, or the market sort of overcorrects and realizes that the economy can't sustain that level of interest rates and actually comes back down. So we're not saying we know, have a crystal ball and know exactly which way it's going to transpire, but just that our belief is structurally the economy can't necessarily handle a level of interest rates that's as high as it's been historically. What that means, so that maybe sounds a little pessimistic, but believe it or not, that's PIMCO's version of optimism. and the reason that's optimism is because that's actually not a bad environment in which to invest. What it means for us is that fairly modest returns, we think around 3% for bonds, around 5% for stocks, but also lower in volatility than we've seen in previous economic cycles. So if the expected returns are going to be lower in volatility, then this is an environment in which one can increase the amount of yield in one's portfolio in order to increase returns. Some of what we've started to do in your portfolio in terms of adding high-quality credits that we believe are likely to be upgraded, and we think over time we'll be able to outperform the benchmark. The other thing that it calls for is continuing to use bottom-up analysis, meaning analyze every corporate balance sheet of things that we buy to identify companies that we think are well-positioned and in those growth areas to outperform over time. We think all of those things together, there's through active management, there's still ample room for outperformance over the next couple of years, just looking very carefully at where it can be sourced from. So let me stop there and see if there are any questions on that.
Why don't, does it make sense to talk a little bit about the organizational changes that we've had at the beginning of the year? And then certainly stops if you want to discuss the outlook in any more detail or anything else that we've covered so far. If you flip with me all the way to page 14, what we've done is we've highlighted sort of the structure for the business management side of the organization. And then on the next page, we'll talk a little bit about the investment management side. So the business management side, I think, is very straightforward. As you all probably recall or know, our CEO and co-CIO, Mohammed Al-Aryan, decided to leave in January. He, in turn, has been replaced by Doug Hodge. Doug was previously our chief operating officer, so you'll see the old structure on the left and the new names on the right. Doug has been with PIMCO for 25 years. He knows the industry well. He's led our business in Asia Pacific, and we're in very good hands from a business management perspective. I won't go through all the other names. The same are true for each one of the folks that's listed on this page. All of them have substantial experience running investment management organizations. All of them have very long tenures at PIMCO, so we're very confident in the management team that we have in place. Of more interest to you, frankly, is on page 15, and that's the structure of the overall investment team. And here we kind of get into a little bit of, you know, arcane PIMCO trivia. But the senior decision-making body from an investment standpoint at PIMCO is the investment committee. And on the left-hand side of the page, we're showing you how the investment committee was structured prior to the changes we made. And on the right-hand side, we show you the structure of the investment committee currently. The key takeaways here is that you'll see on the left-hand side, we had an investment committee that was roughly 11 individuals, and then they were supported by what we used to call desk heads. These were folks who were responsible for specific segments of the fixed income market. For instance, Mark Kiesel is responsible for and has been responsible for the credit sector. The investment committee was led by Bill Gross and Mohammed Al-Aryan. With Mohammed's departure, what we thought was an opportune time to really relook at the structure of this team, and what we've done is we've pulled these individuals who previously had been desk heads, who had been very, very focused on specific market segments, have long track records in of their own right, and elevated them to deputy CIOs. So they are now permanent members of the investment committee. They report to our founder and chief investment officer, Bill Gross, and Bill's been chief investment officer since we were founded in 1971. And then they are supported by a series of very talented senior portfolio managers who also serve on the investment committee. And I won't go through all the names here, but I will highlight Tony Crescenzi. He is our chief global central bank watcher, and he is also your portfolio manager. So he is very much part and parcel to the discussions that go on at the most senior levels of the organization. It's a very, very deep and talented bench of senior portfolio managers, a couple that I'll highlight for you just to kind of give you some data behind that. Dan Iveson was named the Fixed Income Manager of the Year by Morningstar last year. Mark Kiesel was named the Fixed Income Manager of the Year by Morningstar for the year prior to last year. So there's a real wealth of investment talent on the investment committee. And we think this overall structure really is an improvement. We're very, very happy with the results that they've been able to achieve over the course of this year. We think the previous structure got a little bit too far away from that day-to-day market-focused trading activity, and we've brought more of that back in by elevating the deputy CIOs. We brought, we think, really a renewed energy to the broader investment committee, and so we've been very happy with the way that this has been playing out over the last several months. We're coming up on our next economic forecasting session that will be at the very beginning of September, so these folks will be back into sort of their regular quarterly discussions, and they meet on a daily basis, you know, thereafter. So let me pause for a minute there. I'll spend a couple moments on sort of the other news item that you might have heard a lot about, which is mutual fund flows. But any questions on the way we're structured, either from a business management or from an investment management standpoint?
What's a secular forum leader?
Great question. That's another kind of odd PIMCO term. Secular forum is the discussion where we formulate our 3 to 5 year investment outlook, and we call it a secular view because it's longer term in nature. And then once each quarter after that, we have what's called a cyclical forum. So we basically say, okay, here's our view for the next 3 to 5 years, and then each quarter we say, well, how is that 3 to 5 year going to view going to play out for the next 12 months? So we try and marry this longer-term outlook with a short-term outlook. But the process really starts with this secular forum to formulate that longer-term view. And Rich Clarita leads that process and has been very involved in it previously as well.
When I was down in Newport early this year and I met Jay, who said one of his primary jobs was to keep Bill out of the press on the internal doings at PIMCO.
Yeah.
But somehow I keep reading about Bill being in the press with internal.
Yeah.
Can you communicate to Jay? He needs to do a better job.
I will let Jay know. It's one of those things that's tough, Paul, because we're trying to balance, right, the narrative that gets out there. Like, one of the, being well-known in the marketplace definitely brings advantages and brings benefits, but you can't get anything for free. There's going to be a price to be paid. And so we're paying the price this year, right? There's a lot of interest in PIMCO, and you can sell a lot of papers, you can generate a lot of clicks, you can generate a lot of attention by writing about PIMCO. And so we're always trying to make sure that we get an accurate information out to the press, but we also recognize that we don't control the narrative. But to your point, I will let Jay know that any additional efforts he can bring to bear in terms of limiting that sort of interaction would be very appreciated.
Yes, thank you.
The last thing I'll touch on is that in the news, there's been a lot of discussion about flows to and out of PIMCO mutual funds. What all of those stories completely miss is really, I think, the chart in the middle of page 16, is that it remains an exceptionally stable and well-resourced organization. So go back to March of 2013, our assets under management were about $2 trillion. Fast forward today, our assets under management are about $2 trillion. So all of the sort of press like, well, you know, PIMCO has seen all these big outflows. Yes, we have seen money moving in and moving out of PIMCO. We've seen money moving around PIMCO to different strategies. We've seen a lot of interest in some of the more alternative approaches we provide. What kind of gets missed in all of that minutia is that the asset base remains very stable. We're very fortunate to work with clients who are long-term in their orientation, like you, that will be patient in those periods where we're not doing as well as we should be by you, and then also are patient enough to reap the rewards of when we turn around and deliver the good performance that you deserve and you expect. And then that stability of the organization, just sort of on page 17, it's been reflected in terms of the talent of the folks that we've been able to bring in here. So we sort of have a snapshot. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but we have been attracting very senior, very talented investment professionals, both those who have worked at PIMCO previously and others from throughout the industry. The only reason that matters to you is that we continue to reinvest in the business so that we can build good portfolios on your behalf, and that it's the type of place where very, very talented investors want to come and work, and we don't see that changing at all. And in fact, we think the new structure has been a big reason to sort of augment that presence within the community. Let me stop there, open up to your questions.
Can you tell us a little bit about your impression of flows between bonds and stocks in the last couple of years?
You know, it has been really interesting because there's been this big discussion about when is there going to be a rotation out of the bond market and into the stock market. And if you think about what happened last year when the bond market had a really difficult year, the first time in over 10 years where it had negative returns, that money didn't migrate right to the equity market. In fact, it went to, if anything, lower interest rate sensitive strategies, things like money market portfolios. So we haven't seen that really big rotation from bonds to stocks. And in the environment that we think we're going into, which we think will be relatively stable from a Fed policy perspective, from an overall volatility perspective, we think both stocks and bonds are going to continue to see the types of allocations that they've seen in the past. You're not going to see this kind of big switch initially out of bonds and into stocks. And if anything, oddly enough, the bond market, no one expected it to have such a good year. I think some of the fear that people have with the bond market has been sort of diffused by the fact that bonds have done really relatively well this year. And folks are still very mindful of the wild ride that the equity market can provide you. Even though we're cautiously optimistic on equities, we also will be the first to tell you have to kind of go in with expectation for some pretty good swings.
The other thing I'd add to that is some of the fireworks we've seen in the news headlines and whichever has been largely driven by retail investors. But in terms of the institutional investors that Matt and I work with, and specifically public plans, I think more of what we see is when people are looking at their bond allocations, they're looking at things like possibly diversifying globally, those kinds of strategies. So moving within bonds to different allocations as opposed to moving out of bonds altogether. And then similarly with equities, I'd say more of the plans that I work with actually are looking at, well, hey, I have a lot of actually equity risk in my portfolio and that's served me really well, but I also need to be careful about protecting on the downside and maybe shifting some of that into strategies that will hold their ground a little bit more. So that's more of what I see than sort of a wholesale move from bonds to equities.
And a really good example is just, you know, it gets back to why is the 30-year Treasury doing as well as it is. One of the reasons is that pension plans in general, as they get better funded, they say, well, maybe we can step back and begin to immunize some of our liabilities by going out and buying these longer maturity bonds, even though the yields are really low. It's a way to make sure that their assets and liabilities move more closely aligned with each in a more aligned fashion. So on the private sector, we've certainly seen a lot of interest in bond strategies. And even the public sector, as plans get a little bit more fully funded, just to Sasha's point, we've seen some interest in sort of doing things like, well, what can we do to reduce risk in the plan as we begin to approach that 84% plus funded level.
I'm a strong on the fee.
Is it quarterly?
That's quarterly.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's about $390 on the year. Here's my follow-up question, and I'm not interrogating you.
Sure.
I hope you're not thinking that way. Just trying to understand. All right. So on slide 10, Mr. Gross says anticipate modest returns, but bear market unlikely. 3% for bonds, 5% for stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that inflation adjusted?
Yes, that is a nominal return expectation.
And we're anticipating a 2% inflation rate?
Roughly, right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were mandated to make 7.75% on your money,
mm-hmm.
where would you put it?
Well, you do have to expand the opportunities that you're looking for. So we feel very strongly that sort of a traditional approach to traditional stocks and traditional bonds is not going to get you to 7.75%. We think, you know, doing things like looking at the equity market and saying, well, do I have to use, say, a market capitalization weighted index like everyone else does? You can get the equity exposure, but not use that type of index methodology, not take on necessarily a lot of active risk, and generate better returns. It's going to require boards, frankly, sometimes to do things that might be initially outside of their comfort zone. A lot of the best return opportunities are in areas that require you to lock up your money for 3 years, 5 years, if not longer. And though that there is a level of discomfort with doing that, in order to get to that higher return target, we think this is an environment where you're going to have to pursue strategies like this. And then we think that active management, and again, this is so blatantly self-serving, so please take it with, you know, I'm sure you're taking it with a big grain of salt. But if you expect 3% from bonds, if we can get close to and deliver on that return target of outperforming by about a percent, that's a very meaningful amount of incremental return in terms of your total return. And so we would encourage folks to think about extending as much investment discretion as the board is comfortable with to active managers that they trust, because we believe in our active strategies. We feel that over time we will deliver for you. And given that additional discretion, we think that's one way that we can help you get to the return targets you have. But in a nutshell, it basically comes down to acknowledging that what's worked maybe over the last 30 years in terms of traditional stock and bond investing is not poised to get to a 7.75% return over the next 30 years. And the math just makes that almost an inescapable conclusion. I mean, with the yield on the aggregate's 2.1%, so the broad bond market's telling you that for the next 5 years that, you know, basically you should expect something in the neighborhood of 2-ish, maybe a little bit more percent in terms of a passive bond portfolio. Now, we think you can get a bit higher than that, obviously, and that's what we're working to do. But when you start with that sort of math, it's going to be hard for other areas of the markets that are traditionally oriented to deliver meaningfully above that starting point.
The other thing that we see boards increasingly thinking about is, hey, well, if my returns are going to be lower than before, maybe taking some of that return in income versus relying on growth.
Right.
And the reason to do that is, especially if you're a public plan, is just that the amount of, obviously, the benefits you need to pay out every month, regardless of whether the market's up or down, should some of that income be then flowing into the portfolio, that can offset then some of those benefit outflows.
Yeah, that's the balance for a particular public pension plan, because it's easy to say, well, hey, you should kind of run to these less liquid strategies, but the fact of the matter is that your beneficiaries expect absolute liquidity, right? You can't go to them and say 1 month, well, we had a really bad month, so we'll double your payment next month. That's not the way it works for them. So looking for strategies that not only generate high returns, but then also have a really good income component to meet the fact that you're making regular benefit payments, we think is an important way for public pension plans to get to the sort of outcomes they want, which is funding, minimizing contribution volatility, all of those things.
Any other questions?
Well, we very much appreciate your time, and we very much appreciate your trust and confidence in us. We are always available to visit with you, so if anyone has any questions at all, Paul does a great job of holding our feet to the fire, but you're also always welcome to call us, and we'll be happy to continue the discussion any way that you'd like.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That brings us to item 7. Committee report, recommendations, actions, standing committee, internal governance committee.
Okay. Well, Donna is the chair of the internal governance committee, but unfortunately she wasn't able to make the last meeting. And if you recall the last internal governance meeting, one of the subjects that was discussed was the fact that at the last election, retirement board member election, we had the same signature was on two candidates' forms. And what came up in the discussion at the committee level was to check in with the registrar of voters to find out what they would do. Fortunately, in this particular instance, both potential candidates had plenty of signatures, so it didn't come down to whether or not one was going to be qualified or the other. So that was not the issue. But what we did check, staff did check in with the registrar of voters, and what they came back with is if it is determined that two or more candidates for the same seat have duplicate membership electoral signatures, then the candidate that turned in their membership electoral document first shall be the only candidate that may count that signature. So we need approval by the board in order to amend the bylaws to include this language. So just in case in the future, if we ever run into it where we have the same signature and it comes down to a tie, we'll know which way to move forward.
It never hurts to get an extra one or two.
Exactly.
And Tony and I were at, did the meeting and we agreed on this after a very short discussion.
Can we get a motion?
So moved.
I'll second.
Moved and second. All in favor, if I signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? I think you get a pass. Moved item 8.
8A is the quarterly report, second quarter of 2014, and the final quarter of the fiscal year. I notice I'm drinking nice water, so I figure I'll give you a nice report now. And we do have a good report for the fiscal year. I'm going to start on page 1, the capital market review. First quarter GDP was down 2.9%. That was blame on the weather that we talked about earlier, and if you didn't want to blame it on the weather, you could blame it on Russia. Second quarter GDP was up 4%, which was a full percentage point above what was expected on the bounce back. That's going to be revised, I think, this week at some point, so we'll see that. But the interesting stat, even though with Q2 up 4%, subject to revision, for GDP growth for the calendar year 2014 equal 3%, we would need 5% growth in both quarter 3 and quarter 4, and that ain't going to happen. So we're kind of in that new normal that PIMCO has been talking about. Yields, as was just reported, every economist polled at the end of 2013 pretty much said rates were going to go up from 3% on the 10-year, and every economist was wrong. We're at 2.38% right now. And the same 50 economists were just polled again and thought the 10-year would go up to 2.9 by the end of the year. So my suspicion is they'll be wrong again and rates will stay pretty stable.
Well, didn't Yellen just sort of indicate that the plan was to stay, number one, low on interest rates?
Yeah, she's definitely keeping the liquidity pumped, that's for sure. Lower grade corporate debt outperformed. That's good for Dodge and Cox with their portfolio. Remember, they're 3/4 of our fixed income, Dodge and Cox. PIMCO's just 1/4, and they are a good diversifier. European Central Bank in Japan has decided to follow the U.S., and they're easing even more than they had previously. That's helping capital markets there, and the 10 years in Europe are at 1% or slightly above that or below that, depending on the country, Germany, France, Switzerland are all very low. Italy is at the same rate we are at, which shows you the degree of liquidity going on in Europe. And Japan, of course, is below 1%. Emerging markets equities outperformed for this second quarter, up a big 6.6%. That's the first time we've said that in a long while. And real estate, particularly NAREIT, returns have been quite strong, the third bullet point from the bottom, which is helpful with our BlackRock passive REIT portfolio, up 7% for the quarter, 13.2% for the 1 year. And to go to page three, we mixed up the pages. Pages three should be two and vice versa. Executive performance summary, 3.7% nice return in the second quarter, 40th percentile, 20 bips below the policy 3.9. And then you can see good returns 1, 3, and 5 years out. What helped is listed on page three. A lot of these are passive, but Jackson Square was up 40 bips in large cap growth, formerly Delaware. Cap prospects very strong, up 100 bips for the quarter. LSV up 120 bips. On page two, continuing that, Dodge and Cox bonds continue to perform well, up 40. PIMCO flat. And the direct lending has been very, very good, up 3.6 for the quarter versus 2.2 for the 9% annum per quarter. You can see the three managers were all positive. What hurt was Dodge & Cox equity down 50. Legato and Pyramus are the two managers that have fallen behind the last couple quarters. We're watching them. Legato down 320, Pyramus down 130 for the quarter. And actually our only three managers listed what hurt, but our overweight, the small caps, hurt also, as small caps were very weak during the quarter. Page four, assets at the end of the quarter stood at $1,786,579,000 and change. We will reconcile that a little further on the direct lending because the second quarter reports are finalized 45 to 60 days after the quarter, and we're getting that now, but that's going to be...
Yeah, we didn't receive the direct...
That's going to be pretty close. I just saw some emails today from Natalie and our firm, so we will get that. But
can you pause for just a second there? The direct lending, we've made commitments of certain amounts.
Yes.
And then they're going to invest up to that amount, and then at some point we're going to get a defined amount they invested.
Yes, the defined amount that they called. Recall that during the investment period, generally 2 years, there's some capital coming back to us, and that can be recycled during the investment period above what we committed to.
Right.
And then there's some firms that won't call the full amount also. So there's a, but we will have that reconciled, yes.
But at some point for each one of them, it'd be different points for each one of them.
Yes.
We'll convert from an call amount or what we are going to possibly put it to a defined amount invested.
Yes.
And then our fees will be based on a percentage of the defined amount invested.
Yes.
Rather than the committed.
Yes. The fees will translate to net asset value versus callable amount, I believe.
Right. And so my assumption is that we'll get a defined number for each one at a different time.
Yes.
Can you tell us when we have that? Not now, but
yes,
when we do have that time,
I
you
understand.
Can tell us what it will be at that point, because
yes.
Then that will be the amount for all the time in future.
Right. And then from that point forward, we'll be getting distributions back, which we can match to that amount with
right.
The goal of getting distributions above that amount.
Right.
Right.
Good.
Yes, we're in agreement. Page five lists each of the managers. And page six is the performance summary. Fiscal year-to-date, the 1 year to June 30th, up 18.2 versus 16.8, ranking of 14th percentile. 2 years, 16.4 versus 14.2, 220 above policy. And 3 and 5 years, ranked 12th and 7th percentiles, adding 110 and 120 basis points. As I said, all in all, a nice fiscal year. Large Growth, our passive manager, and our actives Jackson Square for the fiscal year 29.4 versus 28.8. 28.8 net. We're listing gross and net of fees now. And the index 26.9, so there was a 190 bips net added. And good performance going 2, 3, 5 years out. Large Value, we have the passive and the actives Dodge and Cox Equity. 27.1 versus 23.8 for the fiscal year. 330 basis points on a net basis, and good, strong numbers going out. Small growth, you see Legato is the manager that struggled. 29 versus 24.7, down 380. Not what we want to see. 3 years on a net basis, they're flat, and 5 years down 60. We'll talk about them a little bit more.
Are you going to talk about what's happened between small and large growth in the last few months?
Mm-hmm. I will. We have a slide a couple pages later that will address that. Cap Prospects has been a very good manager for us for the fiscal year. 25.4 net versus 22.5, 290 over, and good numbers going out. So the U.S. equity composite for the fiscal year, 26.1 versus 25.1 on the 80-20 and 25.2 on the Russell 3, adding 90 and 100 bips respectively there. International, LSV had a very good year. Pyramus did not. LSV up 24.8 net versus 22.3 for the Acquiex U.S. index, up 250. Pyramus 18.2 net, down 410 basis points on a net basis. We will have I will call Pyramus up after this meeting to get a call in with them. Bottom of the page is fixed income. Dodge and Cox, very good year. 6.9 versus 4.4, up 250. And PIMCO, we just heard from. The composite, 6.4 versus 4.4. As I said, Dodge and Cox is roughly 3/4, 4/5 of the total assets in fixed. Real estate, the 13.3 number for BlackRock for fiscal year to date, 7.2 for the quarter. That's been a very, very strong area of the market, and we've been using that strength as a source for private real estate capital calls. And I think our timing's good there. To take that money off the table after the huge run we've seen there. That's just started with the Greenfield first capital call. You see the direct lenders?
We've had two capital calls now in Greenfield. Mm-hmm. We've had two.
Yeah, two,
with
yeah.
Greenfield now.
Why the minuses on the 12th Street building?
Because it went down in value.
Pardon me?
Because they reassessed it, and it actually went down a little bit in value.
Age,
depreciation.
This floor.
Unfortunately,
I don't know the answer to that. I can't answer that one.
It was reassessed this year.
It was the first time in a while it's been reassessed.
Yes, the first time since we've been in. So
we had been carrying the value at cost, I believe, since inception.
So you're basing the assessor's office value as the actual value.
I don't have my account in front of me right now. I just know it went down. It was either the depreciation or the assessor, but I'll have to ask her. I can get back to you and get you that answer.
Well, then the assessor is frequently off on
estimated. Let's not pick on the assessor.
But I can get you. I can make sure you have the exact answer on that for the next meeting.
Gordon's not happy. He's collecting on less fees.
Yeah. How dare you?
He collects less from us all the time.
Direct lending, page 8. You can see the quarter. Raven had a very good quarter. And fiscal year, we realized 11% versus 9. Again, that's subject to some final changes, but that was really our first full year of direct lending that initially has a J curve, and to come out with those results is truly very, very good to see. We're at a point where, you know, a lot of the capital has been called where we should just be being distributed the income on a quarterly basis now, and that's going to be a nice income amount that we'll be seeing. So that's really good news, and that 11%. you know, compared to the bond markets, which had a very good year at 6.4 for our composite and 4.4 for the aggregate, you know, that's the type of number we should see going forward with a yield of 2% in the bond market. And I think that's part of what Matt was talking about, is thinking outside the box and doing some illiquid investments, as long as you get paid for that illiquidity. And I think direct lending is a good spot to be at this point. Page 9, 10-year number 7.6 for the fund versus 7.1. And then page 10, the performance attribution was relatively flat for the quarter. U.S. equity was down due to Legato and our small cap overweight. Pyramus contributed, international being down. Fixed income and direct lending added some value. Page 11 will give a sense on the sectors. We're showing for the quarter in the yellow bars in the bottom right graph chart, utilities 7.8, energy up 12.2. I think I talked about this earlier. We're exhibiting sector strength in late cycle type of environment, although it's kind of silly to talk about cycles given the financial crisis and the liquidity and the Fed support, government support across the globe. It's hard to really tell what's a cycle these days, but the market is treating like late cycle based on sector strength, although that's changed in the last month again with the markets roaring to new highs. I'm going to turn to page 24 in the interest of time, which is Legato. I want to spend a little time on our underperforming managers. Joan, I'll get to your question in the July monthly report performance, and we'll update that. Don't want to forget that. Year-to-date, down 0.8 versus 2.2, bottom page 24. Fiscal year, 21.6 versus 24.7. Page 25, you see it's a diversified portfolio. They have the four or five managers underneath, 458 holdings. Biotech's really hurt them. I talked to them recently. You see some of the worst performers: Regato Biosciences, Athersys, Retrofin, in a sector that's just been screaming to the upside, biotechs. And it's been screaming to the upside for not months, but years at this point. It's been a very strong sector. And it's often tough on active managers because of a lot of the stocks are moving without earnings, but basis on pipelines and the hope that the FDA approves their drugs in phase 3 trials. I'm not defending active managers by any means. Believe me, I'm not. But that's what Legato has said. And it shows on page 26, healthcare selection effect minus 0.5%, although information technology was weaker than that, actually. Page 27, the bottom, the quarterly, up to the last quarter, which was not pretty, they had outperformed 8 out of the prior 11 quarters. So, as always, part of this is point in time off of a really bad quarter. We're looking at them, but, as with all their active managers, including PIMCO, they need to earn their fees and give us excess returns or they don't belong in the portfolio. And I'm cognizant of that. Page 32, Pyramus is the other underperforming manager. 3.9 versus 5.2 for the quarter. Although looking at the benchmark, it was a hard benchmark to beat for the quarter at 17th percentile. A quarter which emerging markets reversed course and outperformed developed, and the ACWI-ex U.S. is roughly 21% emerging markets in the index. Fiscal year to date, 18.7 versus 22.3, again, a very poor quarter. You go out 3, 5, 7 years, they have added value. Again, it's a point in time off a bad quarter, but I will make a point to talk to them in the next week or two, right after Labor Day, see what's going on there and report back to the board. Page 34, attribution, down 1.5 selection effect. Financials was the leading sector contributing to that underperformance. Page 38, bond market. Long duration and weak quality were the two themes for the quarter and the year to date. The longer the duration, the better the performance, as yields have gone down, particularly at the long end of the curve. And the weaker the quality, the better, as spreads continue to narrow and favor weaker credit quality companies. I guess due to the positive economic and corporate stats bolstering the balance sheets of corporates across the spectrum. Question is, when will that end? The best trade in the market since the lows of March 2009, now 5 years, almost 6 months, best trade has been low volatility. There's volatility has gone way down, and whenever we see episodes of spikes like we have recently, thinking about August, on the equity side, we get these V-shaped rallies back at or above where we started with the V, and that's happened again this month. So that's good news, as August is shaping up to be the second best August equity-wise in the last 15 years. But one has to wonder how much longer this can go on, and will it continue to go on with V-shaped rallies. But it helps our plan for sure.
Keep waiting for that big correction. Every week, you know, we're going to say that.
I know.
Be the week,
I know.
The correction lasts for one day, and then market breaks again.
Yeah, I personally, my account, I sometimes hedge with bearish ETFs, and every time I hedge, I lose money. So.
Can you call us when you're going to do that?
I will. 39 are the two fixed income managers, Dodge and Cox Strong, fiscal year at 8.71, PIMCO 4.0. And then page 40 is Dodge and Cox, you know, overweight corporates, 43 versus 23%, virtually no treasuries at 6%, and 28% bottom right in triple Bs and 10% below investment grade from downgrades. PIMCO on the next page, as a complement, as I said before, has 35% in treasuries, equal weighting corporates and mortgages. And then page 42, the bottom right, it's the yield curve, which dropped from March, the orange, I think that's that color, to the yellow figure. And again, the 10-year is like, I think it was 238 I saw right before the meeting. With that, I will stop and take any questions before I go to the monthly. But all in all, I mean, this has been a very nice run for us during this recovery period. We added nice value over a strong absolute return for the 12 months, following a fiscal year where we were one of the top performing funds in the country. 140 bips of alpha is really nice excess returns, and it will definitely help with the next actuarial report that we see on the investment side. Okay, enough for fiscal year 2014. Start 2015. We're going to do July, the first month of fiscal year 2015, and that was a negative month. As you can see here, Joan, on page A, the small caps were down 6.05% value, and growth down is similar, down 6.06%. Russell 1000 was down 1.6%. So that's a good 440 basis points below the 1000 index. Small caps have been quite strong during this rally off the lows up to 6 months ago. And I think we're just seeing some reversion back to the mean with large caps starting to outperform. In theory, small caps over long periods of time should outperform large caps. They're riskier. They have higher standard deviation. And on a CAPM, riskier assets should outperform less risky. And they have over time. But there are periods when we get reversion to the mean after extreme periods, and I would say the small cap rally had been fairly extreme. with small caps on a valuation basis much more expensive on like a price to earnings, price to sales than large caps. We are cognizant of that. We have taken money away from both Cap Prospects and Legato this year to fund, I think, some of the direct lending capital calls.
Yes, we do.
And we'll continue to watch that and try to add value by rebalancing out of the strong sectors into the weak sectors at time.
Is
so,
small cap price earnings about 25 or 30?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, large caps were cheap at 18 times or 16, 18, and small caps were anywhere from 25 to 30, depending the source. So I think it's just a little bit of reversion. But the one-year number, small cap is at 8.56 for the 12 months versus the 1,000 at 17.06. So we have seen a fairly substantial correction. It's hard to tell how much longer that could go on, but I would not hesitate to take more money out of small caps to fund future capital calls as we reduce our U.S. equity allocation. Emerging market equity, we saw in the second quarter outperform, and they did in July also. It was really the only positive equity market, up 2%. The aggregate took a little breather, down 25 bips. Again, all this has been reversed in August. We've had a strong rally in equities, and yields have come down in bonds. So if this holds for the next 3 days, we're going to show 2.5%, 3% gains in equities in the U.S., and bonds should show a nice positive return with yields going down. So that will reverse July and then some. Page one, our asset value went down to $1.759 billion. Asset classes are in line with current policy allocation. You can see domestic equities in the future will go from the current 46.7 to 38.2 to help fund real estate infrastructure and direct lending. Again, real estate will also be using the REIT to as a source for some of the capital calls there. You see Greenfield Gap 7 at the bottom had their first capital call by the end of July 31st. I think it was right a little over $2 million. That represents just 0.1%, but we show them there. And page two, the differences from the prior month, we went down $24 million. As I said, it was the first down month in a while, and at least it came after the fiscal year close. And we're reversing that in August, up $167 million from the prior year, including all monthly benefits paid. Page three, again, we list Greenfield within real estate now. That will go up as capital calls are made, and BlackRock will go down to zero eventually. And on page four, the cash breakouts are, again, minimal for domestic equities and international equities. And we show Northern Trust's cash account, as we alluded to last month, with the change in custodians. Page five is the performance. This is a little unusual, where we had all four of our active managers outperform, yet our asset class slightly underperformed the benchmark, and that's the small cap effect. We have roughly 20.5% of our assets in small caps, and the Russell 3000 has roughly 10%, so we have roughly a double weight. And that cost us, since small caps underperformed by about 460 basis points, that 10% equals 46 bips. So that cost us about 46 bips, the overweight to small caps this month, and we underperformed by 6 basis points. So our active managers in total outperformed by about 37 basis points. We would not expect to see that repeatedly. Bond yields crept up in July. Dodge and Cox was negative, PIMCO negative, both close to the benchmark. Dodge and Cox outperforming, PIMCO underperforming by a slight amount, and total fixed income down 20 bips versus 25. Direct lenders, we had only one of the three managers at the time we published this with their July estimates. Now we have all three. Medley, we show 1.91% gain for July. At White Oak, 0.58%, which would put the asset class direct lending at from 0.25% to 1.13% if we add those two in, and outperforming the 75-bip monthly figure by 38 bips. I will update that and forward to staff, but we just got those two in. Sometimes we don't get them in time. It's hard, but it's good news. LSV underperformed. LSV and Pyramus both negative numbers. LSV outperform, Pyramus underperform again. In total, they were slightly above benchmark on a relative basis, down 95 bips versus down 99. Again, I will talk to Pyramus. And you see Greenfield at $2.122 million first capital call. The REIT was up again in July, 18 bips. Overall, the fund, prior to the those two direct lending updates, was down 1.25 versus down 1.39. With the updates, we're down 1.21 at 4 basis points positive effect. So that's 18 bips ahead of benchmark. We'll take it. We will update the numbers on the direct lenders and get their quarterly numbers finalized along with Stan Sarah's staff. Since that's a fiscal year number, it's important to do that. The rolling 3 years in the back, as one could predict, Legato and Pyramus are falling off. Legato fairly rapidly. I will schedule meetings with both Pyramus and Legato, but all in all, negative month, but not too bad. Excess returns in the month. As I said, it's nice the month happened after the fiscal year, and August is shaping up to be a good month to reverse that. I'll take any questions on performance.
I just want to say one thing, Paul. The only one of the direct lenders that Raven gives us in their partnership agreement, they've got 45 days to get their quarterlies to us. Both White Oak and Medley have 60 days to get their quarterlies to us. So the estimate's supposed to come within 10 days or so,
right. But
it's just that, an estimate.
I know.
So both Medley and White Oak worked hard and did in fact get our fiscal year and quarterlies to us about 10 days in advance.
That's good.
So I just, you know, they really did try to. Normally we get them right around the 60-day mark, but because they know it's our fiscal year end and we contacted them early and they knew that, effort out, and
we just need to incorporate it in our quarter.
Yeah, Natalie, I think we got those Thursday afternoon, so it worked. She was able to stay and keep her deadlines for the auditors, so that was that was really helpful. I don't know if you noticed, but the auditors are on site. So we're working fast and furious, but they did oblige us by getting them to us early.
Good. I mean, I know these firms fairly well. They're good people, so
Because I know we've struggled, like at the fiscal year end, we didn't get things right away, but we did get them for our fiscal year end, which was really helpful.
We have the top 10 holdings. I'm going to be very, very brief on that. Through 8:15, Russell 1000 growth was up 1.9, 1000 value up 1.1, S&P 1.4, and then on small caps, I think we've seen a reversal. Yep, 2000 value up 1.7 and 2000 growth up 2.4. So we started to see small caps outperform in August. Nothing really of note on the top 10 holdings. That it? Yep. That's it for Section 8. Need some more nice water.
Okay. We move on to Section 9, Executive Director, Discussion Action Regarding Infrastructure Investment.
Okay. Actually, Paul is going to take this one, and
yes,
he's been doing all the work and the research on this one up today.
Okay. As you may recall, we have a 3% allocation in infrastructure, and this is our kind of our second go around there. And I have a kind of summary sheet here of two proposed candidates. And I think the place to start will actually be on the bottom of that, where our criteria for selection is. And these private markets are different animals, as we all have learned and know, than public markets. When we're doing a search for a public market manager, it's very easy to go to the database, set your screening criteria, kind of see what pops up, and then through our collective experience, whether it's the board, staff, or myself, we can add candidates to that list. On the private fund market, it's a completely different animal. There aren't databases per se. There are, but they're not as robust as the public markets. And it's subject to also who's out in the market raising funds at the time. That's an obvious consideration. So for infrastructure, there's a couple ways, there's a few ways to go. There's basically three types of areas. One is infrastructure public market equities. There are indexes that have been created. It's fairly new with very small amount of history. Again, these are public market equities that tend to be highly correlated to, you know, the Russell 3000, the MSCI World type indices, and doesn't really give you diversification away from equities. There's MLPs are in that category. We've talked about that in the past. MLPs have their, again, they're public equities. They're like REITs, but they're that distribute income to holders, stockholders. But that has their own issues. Again, you have the issues of public market equities with correlation and not diversification. But there is a tax issue that I fully don't understand, but it has to do with UBIT, and that's unrelated business income. And for institutions like ours that are tax exempt, there may be issues. Most investors in MLPs are retail oriented, and I think that's because of that. So our preference under number one was the private funds over the public equity markets, whether MLPs or just equities called infrastructure, gives us less correlation to our current asset classes. And if we pick the right managers, like in direct lending, there is a illiquidity premium that can be gained, which I think is quite attractive in this type of market, as PIMCO explained, with their lower potential return environment we keep hearing about, but thankfully hasn't happened yet. Within the private funds, there's closed-end and open-ended formats. Closed-end is the prevalent format. There's only a couple open-end funds that we found. We talked about that in the June meeting. J.P. Morgan was one. I think IFS was the other. Frankly, they're comparing those two to the two closed-end funds we're bringing to you today. We prefer the closed-end funds, not the two open-end funds out there. The closed-ends are kind of the traditional type of format like we do with private real estate. We were looking number three for global geographic format versus North America. That's just a larger opportunity set for the managers. Sector exposure, we prefer broad versus limited. We wouldn't want to put everything in a energy pipeline fund versus having four or five sectors. Core versus core plus. Core plus was preferred. That allows them to buy assets that have the opportunity for them to put their managerial skills in place and value-added potential to add returns on operational improvements. Vintage year, these closed-end funds have generally 5-year investment periods, so you get vintage year diversification just from that.
What does that mean exactly, the vintage year?
Vintage year is the year you make the year you buy the assets. So you want diversification because of the economic cycle. There might be times where you're buying at the top of the cycle and at the bottom of the cycle. So diversification allows you to smooth that out. Type of firm, we prefer global large organizations with deep resources, experience. Sourcing is always important. And then a prior fund was preferred, and obviously being out in the market. The two firms we're bringing to you today are KKR and Morgan Stanley. We have experience with both these firms. KKR from 2010, when we looked at their first fund, this is fund two now. And Morgan Stanley, this is the same group where the real estate fund is in, that we just gave a capital commitment in, and we're in the process of legal review. They're both large global firms. They're similar to one another when you look at the key terms, with the left KKR and the right Morgan Stanley. There are some subtle differences. Size of the fund, Morgan Stanley's $4 billion versus $2 billion. You see the closings. KKR is coming up the end of September, and then they anticipate their second closing end of 2014, early 2015. By no means, if we move forward, do we have to rush to make that first close. We can make the latter one. Morgan Stanley is looking for their second close by the end of the fourth quarter also. Fund life is similar. These are long-dated securities, very long-dated, 12 years. In a sense, it's you want a nice liquidity premium for that lockup, and they do match up the liabilities a little bit from that standpoint. Investment period would spread that vintage year risk. Commitments are large by both firms. Management fees, 1.5% for Morgan Stanley, and KKR is 2% going to 1% after the capital commitments have been called. Carried interest.
In reality, what's the difference there?
What's the actual
difference?
You're paying a little more in management fee. It's pretty similar, I would say. You're paying more to Morgan Stanley on a carried interest performance fee. They're higher. And then geography, KKR is Americas and Europe, where Morgan Stanley is the same with Asia and up to 15% emerging markets. You see the sector focus is diversified in the objectives, and each one had a prior fund. This is fund two for both. I've included the presentations for both. Obviously, there are a lot of other funds out there. These are the two that kind of fit my criteria. I know in our experience, my experience with these two firms and funds, by no means is the board has to go ahead with this. We're just at the stage of discussion where we're looking for direction, whether we invite one or both of these firms in to present. We can invite both in as finalists. There's roughly $52 million. It equates to the 3% to allocate. Both, you know, it can be awarded to one fund. It could be split in half. It could be split in half to one and the other half to be placed later at next year, per se. Let's say, see what other funds are out there, because some of the funds not out in the market now will be out in the future. I personally, in our firm, this is an area we've got into the last couple of years. By no means do we know the full spectrum of funds out there. It's as I said, it's not as clear-cut and easy as public markets. It's more who you know, your Rolodex, and just being familiar.
Is that what you're asking for today? Do you really want to hear from these people?
Yes. Do you want to hear from these people with no obligation to move forward with those people?
And then could we decide after we hear from them how much we would like to allocate of any?
Yes.
So we don't really need to grapple with that today.
Exactly. That's not even, yeah.
There is a minimum or something?
What's that?
There's a minimum for each?
It's only 5 to 10 million.
So it's not, okay.
Yeah, so it's not a point. Yeah.
Did we turn down KKR before?
Yeah, there is a history, Mike. Let me, and I had to go back to my notes. Let me, What happened was we initially looked at the mezzanine debt in the fall of 2010. We did actually a legal review of their mezzanine debt with Scott Smith from Hanson Bridget, but we ended up pulling that as investment as we could never get comfortable with a mezzanine debt fund type of product. It was more the risk of the product, I think, than KKR itself. And in retrospect, I think the board made the right decision there also. Understandably, I said. Ultimately, on the infrastructure fund, which KKKR did come here and did an education session on their infrastructure fund, it was this gentleman, Raj, presented, I forget his last name. We decided to pass on their infrastructure fund, and we ended up looking at RBC, which had a whole other story attached around it that we ultimately committed to but didn't get the investment off the ground because the whole team was fired out of RBC during that period. Talk about PIMCO and soap operas. This is a little bit of one, too. So my understanding was with KKR, it was more the mezzanine fund as a concept, maybe not the fund, firm itself.
Right, no. Right.
And on the infrastructure fund, they presented, but we never moved forward. And that infrastructure fund one has now got a history, and it's been pretty good. And they're coming out with fund two. So that's kind of the history there.
So based on your page five recommendation, is it your idea that we would just interview KKR? Would that be your recommendation?
That was from 2010, though. That was from 2010, yeah. I just wanted to include that memo for the history yet.
So your current recommendation would be that we
interview both firms with no obligation.
Yeah.
As I recall, when we were back in 2010, they'd had like a good year followed by a really bad year followed by a good year.
Well, the infrastructure...
There wasn't a lot of history.
It was a new fund, Gordon, yes.
Yeah,
so this is a better time, I think, because they do have a history with Fund 1 that they can talk to us about. Exactly right. Same with Morgan Stanley. It's fun, too, for them.
Is that Raj guy still?
Yes, he's still part of the team.
No, that's not the Raj guy that went to jail for...
No, different Raj.
Hey, Jason, anything from inside the industry that we should be concerned about between these two?
No, not at all. I think we should talk to both of them. You made a comment that it's the same Morgan Stanley group that we did the REIT with. Or you mean it's the same management team?
No, it falls within the same silo.
The same mother company.
Yeah, the same mother company and the silo within the mother.
I was going to say, because if we're...
No. Like it's completely different than...
REITs with the same guy.
No.
Yeah.
Not
interested. Management fee of 1.5%, does that seem high to you?
It always does, yes, but it's...
For instance, like State Street, what do they charge? Less than 1%.
Well, it's not a private vehicle, though. These are private vehicles, so it's kind of like what we did with the real estate and direct lenders. It's more applicable, apples to apples with them than with our public market funds. It always seems high, and it's taken me a while to look at things on a net basis. But
there's a lot higher return. Right?
Yes, but that is something we would try to negotiate, too.
As the one says, under 50 million, 1.5%. If it's over 50 million, they won't say what it is.
Yep, we can try to negotiate. I know these people, so.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion that we interview both as presented by SIS with no obligation to invest in either one. I'll second that.
We have a motion second. Any discussion? Okay, everybody. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? You got it.
Just one thing, just to let you know, staff has done quite a bit of research trying to find somebody like Jason recommended to do an independent review of these infrastructures, and we've not been successful finding anybody to do an ad hoc type of interview.
Right. I need to do more work on that.
Okay, so we're
still
working
time.
On that. We've got time, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that right now we don't have somebody like MFS or something like that. We don't have someone to do an independent review at this point in time for infrastructure.
And it might be very difficult to find someone.
Right, and that's not a good or a bad. Right, at this point it doesn't look like it exists. So I'm just kind of letting you know so you not to expect that necessarily before they come in.
My fear is that if we do find someone, the cost might be prohibitive too.
But at this time, there won't be an independent review prior to them coming in to speak to you.
Okay, value-added report.
All right, I'm going to be really quick because we need to get Scott on the phone here pretty soon. Because he said he had a hard 4 o'clock deadline, so we're going to try to get Scott on the phone for the closed session.
To begin at 4 or end before?
End at 4.
Oh, okay.
We're good. Okay, the value-added. This report is meant to associate the fee StanSara pays to manage its active portfolio with the returns the active managers are achieving. Basically, value-added is simply defined as the number of dollars a manager earns above the benchmark, less all the fees, including the custody fees related to those managers. This report is published quarterly just for you, and remember, it is relative to the benchmark. The fixed income portfolio continues to be the greatest contributor to the relative value. Dodge & Cox fixed income has not had a losing quarter in 2 years. They've had only 4 losing quarters in 5. At the very least, this rate of success may suggest that StanSara at least consider a subset of the Barclays aggregate as a more appropriate benchmark for Dodge & Cox fixed income, and staff is planning to look at that in 2015. Year over year, Legato and Pyramus have been the biggest detractors, which of course Paul has spoken to already today, and he's going to be talking to them after the holiday. The notable gains over the year came from Dodge & Cox fixed, Jackson Square, Capital Prospects, and LSV. Kind of skipping down, quarter over quarter, overall manager fees increased.
You'll probably get updated.
Next quarter and year over year, StanSara paid about 33.1 basis points in fees to manage its portfolio. This compares favorably with the 35 basis point average that most of our 37X systems are paying. So we're still doing pretty good on that. Next quarter, our new fee structure for Northern Trust will be fully integrated within this report. We didn't get a bill from Northern Trust yet, so we'll get that at the end of this quarter.
Give me a dollar amount for that 33.1 basis point.
It's
what page is that on?
Because total fees in 33.1 over the year is 5.5 million. It says total fee summary. They're not numbered. I'll have to get after the staff member who put this one together. That was Rick. Tell him to fix his page numbers. So we do. With custody fees and manager fees, it's a bit of money, so they do need to earn it.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Except cumulatively, all active managers except Legato have added value over the last 5 years. So we've done pretty well. And we continue to monitor it, and Paul is on and keep holding their feet to the fire.
And you said that was added value net of fees.
That's added value over the benchmark net of fees, yes.
Do you know what you need to do?
I do.
Right.
I know who to slap and who not to.
And the average fee is your 30 basis points.
35? That's pretty good, especially since we've added some private partnerships that remains very low.
Well, that which would lead to believe that fee would creep up a little bit.
Oh, it would have to, yes. But we
just based on current patterns.
Right, but so in our excess, returns better go up too with that. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Everybody, they're going to be talking.
Cool.
Yeah. It's nice to see the
report. That page on Legato is very dramatic.
Yeah. It's kind of.
Yeah.
You see, they're only 3 year, and that's 3 years, not 1 year, in the way it's fallen off. Yes.
Yeah, that's just.
so we will be...
They understand this, I hope.
They should know before we do. They don't.
That's You'll explain it to them.
That's not good. It's not good. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Legal update?
Yeah, the next is a legal update, and Dawn prepared this, and she is on jury duty for about 2 months. So if anybody has any questions regarding this, perhaps I can answer them. We reported to you that the Committee for Pension Fairness, formed by Ventura County taxpayers, had gathered enough signatures to place an initiative on the November ballot in Ventura County. The initiative would replace the county's current 37 Act pension with the 401k style. On August 4th, the Ventura County Superior Court judge ruled that this measure was not legal and therefore it could not go on the ballot.
Wasn't there another court hearing like the day after our last meeting? I thought there was going to be another court report, another decision.
There may have, Joan. I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that. Like I said, Dawn got pulled into jury duty. And so she had an opportunity to chase it quite as diligently as she has. Yeah, the trend is attack, but the trend has been attacked for quite some while. For quite some time they've been attacking.
Not a surprise.
Well, you know, given what Hearst did this week, I think all the systems have a target on their back.
Yeah.
You mentioned that everybody's aware of Brown not being happy with what Hearst did.
I believe Rick sent that email to everybody. Yeah.
I think that's only the public. He approved 32 and 33.
No, we're good. We're good. Okay. Ready?
Hold your breath. Anything's possible.
Need a motion.
I move we move to closed session.
Second.
You want to take credit? Who wants it?
Yeah. Raising and Derek.
Okay.
Wow.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? No. We're back in session, out of closed session. No other closed session.
Yeah, so nothing to report out.
Nothing to report out. Okay, we made it all the way down to members' forum. For you?
Nothing for me.
Nothing for me.
Pass.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I
have
nothing.
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 What a good
nothing.
Group.
I said my
say. You're on the record. Stephanie, anything?
I do have one little thing. It was brought to my attention that some new business cards need to be ordered for a trustee since we're going to be ordering some. Is there anyone else who needs business cards?
If you're ordering cards for me, just say them.
You weren't the trustee, but... Okay.
Good.
Got enough cards, huh?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All righty.
All right, that's it.
We stand adjourned.
All righty.